This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, October 21st, the Norris Group proudly presented its 9th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds from the event benefited Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
There's definitely a lot of money pouring in trying to disrupt real estate right now.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's almost like everybody's so worried about Zillow way back when, but, you know, there's a lot more happening right now, I think.
The way you described it, again, I shared this with you. Sean's much more tech-versed than I am. He shared that you really were a big service to an agent that had a listing, that if they were in the listing business, that your listing goes there for free, and it's really, you're not trying to be a competitor with them. You're trying to be a kind of a partner and drive interest, and they could receive the leads as a buyer interest, or another agent could. And so is that generally your model, is that you're trying to get, if you have any interest at all, and I went to your website, I'm not super familiar with it, so I went to the website and really looked at it. So literally, if I want anything, it seems like I can go there first and get a pretty good understanding of who's players in an area and get a lot of information at my fingertips and start from there. And that's kind of the idea, I think, is you want to be where people start.
It is. You look at the mission statement is to become the largest marketplace online, and just in May was one of our largest months. 171 million unique visitors in a month came to one of our assets or sites. But yet, when you look at the number of transactions that'll be done, even last year's compared to this year, 5.8 million, not including new construction, that number may change year to year by a couple hundred thousand, but you have this huge, huge number that's looking online. And so what's interesting is it's disrupted the advertising space. And if you think about even many of you in the room that have purchased a property or picked up one of those homes magazines outside of a convenience store when you vacation, they didn't allow you to put those listings in advertising mediums for free. And quite honestly, the shift in the market where the pocketbooks literally of brokers and agents dried up, their marketing spend was gone. For a matter of 4 years, were some of our biggest years of growth. And I think that's partly due to the fact that, yes, all listings come on the site for listing agents, and it's free. And it's only when someone wants to engage and pour gas on it to generate more leads and buy advertising that the agents then spend. And we currently have about 90,000 agents within the U.S. that are actually spending customers. But it's also, listings are tied to our ability to place advertising as well. So it's a value exchange that takes place, but the goal in creating this marketplace is to have this huge online audience and then connect them with real estate professionals once they're ready to engage. And you're right, what we're finding in consumer behavior is they start with us because they want data, they want information. The Zestimate is what started the organization, and we didn't have listings for 2 years.
How's that number derived, by the way, and how accurate? Can I go to the bank with it?
I'm very quickly figuring out why I was invited on this panel. So the Zestimate is a really interesting topic because I heard a few chirps. I won't ask you to raise hands. Those are probably from real estate professionals. But yeah, consumers love it. We have a median error rate of 5.4%. However, that's just going to say nationwide. It varies so much by market. There are a handful of states that are non-disclosure, that they don't publish sold data. So we run this estimate on 110 million homes every single evening. And it's a very complicated process. But we take any type of data that we're provided on the property, most of it being public data, beds, baths, square footage, lot size, and we encourage homeowners to update your data because that's going to change your estimate. But what's important here, and especially for professionals in the real estate world, people get locked onto the Zestimate number, go down a little farther and look at Zestimate details, and there's a range. And that's typically what, whether you're an investor, whether you're a buyer or seller working with a real estate professional, you're working off a range anyway. So we encourage people to dig deeper on it because it's generally pretty accurate in that range.
Okay. I actually have a Spencer Raskoff story. I was moderating a panel one time with his CEO. And backstage, I was saying, hey, is there any questions you don't want me to ask or that you want me to ask? And he says, well, you know, your audience is mostly real estate professionals. I know how much they don't like this estimate. So go ahead. Feel free to ask me about that. So I went on stage, and I somehow misspoke that. I said, you know, most of our audience can't stand Zillow. And he says, I didn't say that. I said this estimate.
Oh, well.
Got a good sense of humor.
So that was the end of your moderating.
Some agents do hate Zillow, but...
Well, I'll tell you what, now that we're getting more and more accurate, this is a true story. Just 2 weeks ago, I was speaking to an agent audience, and we talked about the rate had gone from about 7.5 to 5.4, and a lady stood up, raised her hand, and she said, please don't get them any more accurate, because that's how I generate with my sellers value for my commission, is they will have this estimate in their back pocket and say, Mr. or Mrs. Seller, let me tell you why. Zillow hasn't seen your home. But I have, and I can price it for you. But guess what? If we create that conversation between a real estate professional and a seller, and they can capture that client, win. It's just some don't know how to use it as a tool. So it's education for us.
Okay.
You know, we also provide an estimated value. And there's a couple of things. Like, one, the Zillow's estimate has done more than anything else in the last decade to prove the value of a realtor than anything else, right? Why realtors would have any issue with the Zillow's estimate, it's the best thing that could have happened. It was a complete layup to show you how add value, right? So that's one. Number two, you know, we have our own estimate as well. And the thing you have to remember is he just listed off the characteristics that are used in these things, right? So was curb appeal in there? Was view in there? Was, you know, I mean, the last time I was up at Zillow and chatting with them, they were saying, you know, look, we're really trying hard to get in data on where water is so we can tell the difference between waterfront and non-waterfront. Because from a public records perspective, you're on an oceanfront street. The house on this side that's on the ocean and the house on this side, from a public records perspective, are identical, right? And you get into a neighborhood where, you know, the neighborhoods where things were kind of infill and there's like all different qualities of houses and time built, no chance it's going to be accurate. You get into a large subdivision of nearly identical homes, it's going to be spot on. And if you know that couple of things, then A, you can look at an estimate and know whether it's good or not, and B, you know, show add value if you're in the real estate space.
Gary, this is probably the last question of this segment. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back up here. The mood of the lending industry, just every time I open the paper today, Department of Justice deciding to probably sue Moody's for bond assessments a decade ago. So I guess there's still that overhang of concern that if I was a lender, I'd still be looking over my shoulder. And I guess what I wanted to ask, does that continue to force the industry to have overlays that are restricting people that maybe could really get loans and that just there's no way that this environment's going to let that happen?
Yeah, I think that to answer your question, yes, it is affecting overlays. And for those of you that don't know what overlays are, Fannie, Freddie, FHA sets underwriting guidelines. But the lenders have the option to actually add to those guidelines or to make those loans more restrictive. And they do that to make sure that their loans are squarely inside the box, and there's very little risk that those loans will go into default. So yes, when you see the Justice Department using 200-year-old laws to go after lenders and charge them treble damages for making an underwriting error, clearly that's going to suppress the enthusiasm for those lenders to go out and make loans, especially loans that are on the margin, right? So that's one of the reasons why credit access is tighter today than it's been historically. It's not just because Fannie and Freddie don't have products that are relevant in today's marketplace. I think there's clearly an opportunity for improvement there, but lenders are really nervous about getting fined. They're also nervous about any loan going into default because the CFPB has set new rules around how to service loans that go into default. It's much more costly to service a loan that's in default, probably 10 times more than it was 10 years ago. And so that also plays into the equation. So until I think we get a better balance from a regulatory standpoint, and not all regulation is bad, I'll say that. I think we absolutely needed regulation to be a little bit tighter than what it was pre-crash, but clearly the pendulum has swung too far the other way, and it's affecting buyers' opportunities to participate in homeownership, no doubt.
Follow-up question. I've never seen a blueprint of how to deal with somebody that didn't make a payment like the one we just experienced. Before, you had to foreclose, and this time you almost had not to foreclose. It was, let's don't foreclose. So is that a blueprint going forward? If we have an event that causes a lot of foreclosures, have we seen the playbook that's going to be played out again?
Well, I think so. I mean, obviously, a lot has changed since that crisis. We don't want to go to a scenario where foreclosures are gone completely. I mean, clearly, foreclosures are not good for the family that it's affecting. We don't want to see that. But what's the alternative? The alternative is that these become personal loans and interest rates become much higher. I mean, mortgages will be like credit card loans.
Right, the unintended consequences.
So yeah, that's
be
the
a
unintended consequences.
To do it.
And so I'd much rather have access to 3 or 4% mortgages and have the risk that some of those loans will go bad and go into foreclosure. And I think without that out there, then mortgage lending is going to become much more costly. We don't want to see that either.
No. All right. Thank you for your participation in this segment. We're going to take a break, and then we'll all come back.
Okay.
Number one question, and thank you for giving me some questions and input, but this was certainly going to be one of them. And this is going to be an open panel, so anybody that wants to contribute an answer, feel free to do so. So any of you concerned that we're reaching a peak in price? Yeah? Is that good? Wait. You're not on the panel. You can't answer that. Doug, I know you have an opinion, so I'll ask you to start.
I'm sorry, what the peak in price?
Oh. Well, it depends on what geography you're talking about.
Okay.
I think you're at a peak of price in the San Francisco area. But I think it is geographically determined. We expect prices nationally to go up about 5% again next year.
Oh, well, that's not our peak then, that's for sure.
But that's nationally.
Yeah, well, so that's a big jump nationally.
Take a look at Miami. We think prices might go down in Miami. If you look at, particularly the higher price points, you're seeing a big expansion in inventory.
Okay.
So that's a starting comment.
Okay. Do you have any input, Sean?
I was speaking just a couple of weeks ago, and I went before a broker, a large broker with about 800 agents, and he said, you know, look, if you take the 4%, you know, annual appreciation trend line, which it's a made up number, I think, but you know, one that some people believe in. If you take that from 2000, kind of going forward, you'd put us for California at 425 today, right? We're at 526 according to the National Association of Realtors. But if you took the peak and you took that 4% a year from there, it goes to 850, right? And so his point was we've got a lot of room to go. I don't think we have the same economic environment that we've had historically. I think despite, a lot of people have heard me say this, despite the California Association of Realtors affordability chart, which you and I have talked about a lot, which still says we've got some room to go, I think it is different this time. And I think in terms of real world, actual affordability, ability to have down payment, we may be at the least affordable statewide on average that we've ever been. That's my take. And I think, you know, we probably are at a peak. That said, I don't expect a crash.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that if you look at it anecdotally, if you ask 100 real estate agents in California and maybe many other markets what their biggest challenge is right now in terms of getting deals done, they'll tell you inventory. There's still a shortage of inventory in many markets. So I think as long as agents are still saying that, it's hard to think that we're already peaked out. I think there's still room to go.
Interesting.
We put out more than a 50-page report on 70 markets every single month, and I can't find the fundamentals trending down in any market except Houston. I think we have a 2% price decline forecast in Houston, but that's about it. But I think there's about five or six markets that are getting frothy, and will crash hard once the next recession hits, but the next recession's not hitting right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Interest rates. What's the opinion of what the Fed's move is? And if we did have an interest rate hike, how would that affect real estate?
I've been telling lies about interest rates for a long time, so... if you look at our, I don't have the privilege of not being public. I have to publish a public forecast. So if you look at our forecast, we don't see rates at the end of next year being much different than they are now. A little bit on the upside. You've seen a little bit of upward movement on the 10-year treasury, which is really the important metric for mortgage rates. And that probably has to do with the market's assessment of what global central banks think about the value of negative interest rates and a couple of changes that were made by the Bank of Japan and the EU. So whether the Fed moves a quarter of a point in December or June has essentially no bearing on the mortgage market. And if them moving a quarter of a point brings down the economy, we've got a lot bigger problems.
So we look in the Bloomberg terminal for the forward on 10-year treasury. Is this on?
Yes.
The market is essentially betting that 10-year treasuries will only go up 40 basis points over the next 3 years, and mortgage rates trade off of that. So that's what the bond market is betting at, and I'm not smarter than the bond market, so I'm running with that. The other thing I'll mention, though, and we're actually putting out a white paper on this week, mortgage rates have risen 100 basis points or more only 10 times in the last 42 years. Three of them were associated with recessions, but the other seven, home sales on average only fell about 7%. So if that's the moniker, and you know, we have so much discussion like a rise in mortgage rates is just going to kill us, I don't think a rise in mortgage rates is going to kill us as long as the economy keeps growing. At least that's what's happened historically.
Yeah, can I interpret that? I agree with that. And there is a misunderstanding about there being a causal relationship between interest rates and house prices. The relationship is between interest rates and the level of home sales. So if interest rates are rising because the economy is growing and real incomes are rising, the rise in that interest rate and the mortgage payment related to it is offset by the growth in real incomes, and housing does just fine. If interest rates are rising because there is an increase in inflationary expectations at the household level, they look at housing as an intermediate term hedge against inflation. Housing does just fine. If rates are rising because the Fed believes inflation is growing and they're attempting to slow economic activity, then the number of home sales falls.
Any additional comment? What about the Fed's policy overall? Has it been the correct policy that they've implemented?
Yeah, right. You've seen my chart on the relationship of the height of the Federal Reserve chairman and the level of interest rates, right? So Paul Volcker was 6 foot six, Greenspan, right?
Robert Brown's awesome.
Right.
But I mean, I think there's no question that interest rates in the mortgage-backed security market would be much higher if the Fed hadn't broken their rules, basically, and started buying mortgage-backed securities. And that was a very big change in policy prior to 2008. They weren't buying mortgage-backed securities. So clearly they stepped in, and they're really the only reason we have a housing market today.
Yeah, I would argue that long rates, after 2012, in 2012 the Fed did its first QE, and then Operation Twist, which is a way of saying that they changed their securities purchases to try to drive down long-term interest rates. All the rate declines after that period, in our view, have been a function of global issues. And the U.S. while the U.S. economy is not great, it's still the best-looking horse outside the glue factory. And we've looked at the relationship of investment by foreign domiciled nations, corporations in the U.S., net from U.S. domiciled corporations investing overseas, and the U.S. is clearly the beneficiary. So in order to invest in the U.S., there's a capital inflow here, which has pushed rates down, long rates down, in our view.
Even that, though, was dependent on the Fed having done that. So if they hadn't provided that backstop, there wouldn't be that confidence in that product.
Very fair.
The other thing, I'll jump in on this. In terms of consumer behavior, because we look at a lot of consumer behavior on how these things impact what's their next step going to be. Last year, 47% of all sales were first-time home buyers, and 50% of those were under the age of 36. I think what would be interesting is really when first-time home buyers, and more are pre-approved, 87% are pre-approved before they even go shopping. That's been a huge shift in the last 10 years on mentality. But they're saying, what is my payment? Can I afford my payment? And so whether the interest rate's 3, 4, or 8%, it's can I afford my payment? And I think if they go up to a point where it's going to affect first-time home buyers especially, is we're going to start seeing them get into true starter homes. If you look last year, the first-time home buyers, the average property was 1,900 square feet, 3 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, and pretty new. Because they see it as a reflection of themselves now. And our behavior, we just came out with a new study last week on housing and this whole topic of consumer behavior and segments. And it's almost if the young people buying today want to live in the same quality of home that they were raised in, like their parents. So where it'll shift in our mind on consumer behavior is they'll still want to own a home, but they're going to have to settle for the 2-bedroom, 800-square-foot bungalow that they're going to have to fix up.
Aw, shucks. That sounds just like the first house I bought, actually. The economy. So somebody that I pay attention to, Kyle Bass, founder of Heyman Capital Management, warned that U.S. is headed toward stagflation. I wasn't ready for that one.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Auction.com, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA Green Designs, LA South Rhea, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Orange County Building Industry Association, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Realty Executives Inland Empire, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Chase Photography, Wholesale Capital Corporation, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.